Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. He's been called one of the 50 most influential people in American media. David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR News. His stories are heard on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Here and Now, as well as on NPR's website and mobile platforms. He joined NPR in 2004 after a decade as a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, where he covered higher education, politics, and the media. His book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, has been described as, quote, meaty reading and the gift that keeps on giving. WPSU's Christine Allen talked with him during his recent visit to Penn State University Park.
David Folkenflik from NPR, welcome to Take Note.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
You have a degree in history from Cornell. Did you always intend to be a journalist?
No, it never occurred to me I would be. I was interested in history. I thought maybe I'd be an academic, as my parents are and were. I thought perhaps I'd go into certain kinds of public service. You know, I thought maybe I'd be interested in some ways in participating in politics. But I got to campus and the protesters were so impassioned and so at times inflamed in what they were talking about. And good for them. They believed in what they were doing. But that was not a tone that struck true for me. It made me interested, but I felt kind of a little detached as though I was observing things. And I didn't know quite what to do. So there was a guy who was a year older than me named David Silby, whose father was a professor there. And he encouraged me to go down to the student newspaper, which was downtown, and to offer some humor columns. He said, you know, you can do some decent one-liners, see what you could do. So I did that for a semester. And at the end of this barrel-chested guy from Louisville, he's now a prominent rabbi, but at that time he thought of himself purely as a journalist. And he sat me down. And he said, all right, Folkenflik, we're going to teach you how to write a news story. And I was hooked because suddenly they handed you a reporter's notebook. You took a pen and it ended up being a passport that allowed me entry to all these different little nooks and crannies of campus life. You know, you kind of could explore the Cornell archipelago by being able just to knock on somebody's door, whether it was the chairman of the board of trustees or a custodian in a union, and figure out what made them tick, why they felt the way they did, what mattered to them. And it allowed you to see things from the American Indian Student Union to the lacrosse team to all different slices of campus life. And that was so useful to me. And it kind of ruined me for anything else. You know, I studied history and that was very useful. I studied history and political science and economics and literature and some other things as well. A tiny bit of art history I wish I had done more with. But it all kind of infused me with the sense that there's a lot of the world that can be really stimulating if only you knew about it. And it tapped into a latent sense of curiosity, I guess. And I kind of was, as I say, ruined for anything else.
You mentioned a reporter's notebook, an actual notebook.
Yeah, well, you know, they hand you an actual notebook. You know, okay. It's about as wide, maybe a little wider than this iPhone I'm holding at the moment. And, you know, the spiral wire that holds it together is at the top. When I did some reporting later on about the reporters of the civil rights movement in that era, I learned that, and this may be sort of half true and half legend, but I learned that it became popularized among reporters because it was something that could be easily slipped into an inside jacket pocket as a way of hiding and masking from local law enforcement officials in the South who often had ties to segregationist groups, sometimes even the Klan these many decades ago, to hide the fact that you were a reporter. You know, reporters were not always welcome in smaller towns in the South reporting about the issues of segregation and injustice. So the reporter's notebook has this interesting historical echo as both a very useful item and also a vestige of an earlier era in which reporting mattered a great deal to get this issue in front of the nation's consciousness.
You're a media correspondent for NPR News. Can you tell me what that's like, what a day in the life of David Folkenflik is like?
Sure. I've got my wife and I have two small kids, and so we get up fairly early. And when things are under control there, I'll do what I call checking my traps.
And traps?
Yeah. So, you know, if you're a lobster fisherman off the coast of Maine or something, you're going to check traps at some point of the day to see whether you've come up with anything. Well, in the morning, what I'll do is I'll check my email and I'll scan headlines and I'll scroll through Twitter. And I've picked the people I follow on Twitter reasonably well enough. You've got other journalists in all different kinds of beats around the world. You have academics, news leaders, news analysts, people who analyze the news business, financial figures, regulators, politicians, human rights activists, all kinds of little tripwires for stories that might be of interest to somebody who covers the media. And so I find that I almost invariably learn about news before my editors. And that's incredibly useful because I can already have sent out emails or made certain kinds of assessments. One of the great things about NPR is how collaborative and how collegial they are. You know, you're not simply ordered to do stories. You're consulted. And they say, what do you think about this? You're our person. We're relying on your expertise here. What do you think? And, you know, in those moments, I can have sent out some emails and get some information back and offer some guidance. You know, that takes time to check those traps, but it doesn't take so much time that I can't make sure that I'm not present with my kids, maybe reading a book or two, getting their yogurt or juice boxes out or whatever we might be having that morning. And after I take my elder daughter to preschool, I'll usually be on my way to work. Now, at work, there are kind of three layers of things you're doing. You're following the stories about the media because there are a ton of people out there one way or another who are reporting on issues relevant. I'm often taking time just to consume media myself. I'll dip in and watch some cable news. I'll go to a bunch of different news sites and websites. I'll click on a lot of links on social media to other stories. Oftentimes, the most interesting ones have been served up for me, so I don't have to go hunting, which is, I think, true for everyone. And then I'm working on my own stories. You know, I've already – there are stories I did a story not so long ago about BuzzFeed and about there are these four 20-somethings who are kind of like an opposition research team drilling deep on the archival knowledge of all the major presidential candidates through this primary season. And in that way, these guys have become in some ways authorities on the past rhetoric of these very prominent people. So a lot of the research they've done have ended up in the, you know, when Mitt Romney made a grand speech denouncing Donald Trump. He relied on a number of facts that they had unearthed from Trump's past, ways in which Trump has contradicted himself, ways in which his rhetoric has been inflammatory. When CNN's debate moderators are going through their research with their producers, they're clearly relying on a number of clips and stories that these young kids who have never covered a presidential campaign but are unearthing stuff for BuzzFeed of all places have come up with. When there are ads against various of the candidates, you've seen Ted Cruz rely on some stuff against Trump. You've seen this new Republican political Action Committee rely on some stuff that Trump has said about women over the years in a very effective advertisement, or at least rhetorically effective. I don't know how many votes it swayed so far. But you're seeing these young people rely on that. Well, that took – I had to spend an afternoon at BuzzFeed and interviewing these folks. I had to spend some time preceding that, researching and preparing it. I did my own recording. I do my own pulling of audio, you know, and I'm putting it together in a clipboard so my editor and I can listen to different clips and make sure that I'm using the right ones with the script I'm doing. And, you know, NPR is a pretty lean place. You're not having a ton of people do that before you. You have a lot of production help on the back end. Well, all that stuff takes time. So even as I'm living very much in the moment and immersed in media and thinking about both what they're doing and meta questions about how the media is performing, I'm also trying to do other stories that I've sort of plotted out for week. So that's kind of how a layered way in which I think about doing the beat.
You report on media outlets, and you work for one, for NPR.
Unless you've heard differently. Unless I've been fired.
And you sometimes actually report on NPR. Is that ever awkward?
Sure. You know, it's complicated to report on your friends or your peers or your colleagues. I know many people who work for places like the Washington Post or NBC or CNN or the New York Times, some of whom I worked with closely over the years. And so there are people that you respect and care about, and they become part of the news. And NPR, you know, is the most, in some ways, pure form of that complicated moment. I look at it as NPR living its values. So I've certainly done stories that have been uncomfortable for the network. I've certainly done stories that didn't always reflect wonderfully upon the network. And yet in that moment, knowing that the network has procedures in place for me to do this story untouched by anybody who had any involvement in the story that I'm reporting upon, and that's an important protection, I feel NPR can say, look, this is a complicated moment for us, and we're telling it to you because we think that as listeners, you probably more than most people want to understand what that story is about. And yet we live our values. We try to be as transparent as we can. We try to be as straightforward as we can. We are grown-ups. We will treat you as grown-ups. I work for NPR. My paycheck's signed for NPR, and I really love NPR and love working for it. But I don't speak for the network. I'm paid by the network to report and critique the media, and NPR is part of that. So there are times I do that about NPR, and that's got to be okay. It has always been a source of discomfort I've reported on a ton of CEOs. There was for a while there a fair amount of turnover for a variety of different unrelated reasons, but that turnover itself became part of the story of NPR, where it was at times a little hard for NPR to chart a course. I think we've now been moving along more smoothly, and I'm glad for that. And that's part of the NPR story as well. You know, the CEOs are people who know that if they're going to take the job, they're going to have to sit down with me and be held accountable, and they're fine with that. That's part of the job.
I want to remind everyone we're listening to Take Note here on WPSU. I'm Christine Allen. I'm talking with David Folkenflik of NPR. And at a recent lecture you gave at Penn State, you talked about how the media has missed the Donald Trump story and actually helped to enable his rise. How has that happened?
Well, I think that the media thought that Donald Trump would be a flash in the pan, kind of similar to Michelle Bachmann, the congresswoman who kind of popped up for a little bit in polls and then dissipated because she had no real national base of support. I think that they expected him to be like Herman Cain, a highly entertaining former Godfather's Pizza executive who spoke in these great aphorisms and promised a tax plan of the 999. Very catchy. Didn't seem like the numbers would really work, but very memorable, and he's sort of imploded relatively quickly. Donald Trump did not. Donald Trump had, unlike those two people, had almost universal name recognition in the country. Donald Trump, whatever his true net value is, and a number of very credible analyses have shown that, you know, it's a wildly inflated account. Donald Trump in deposition sort of indicated that his net worth is based in significant part on his brand equity, which is to say the value of his name, and that he admitted, I think, under oath, I believe this to be the case, as unearthed in a book, that a lot of that depended on his mood and would fluctuate depending on how he felt about his brand at that moment. So that's, you know, not all those billions may be actually billions of dollars, but he is an exceptionally wealthy man. And so he has a capacity to spend a lot of money to help his own infrastructure. He had put himself in the national spotlight by being the nation's most prominent birther against President Obama, claiming against all evidence that President Obama probably was not born in Hawaii or this country and therefore was not eligible to be president of the United States. And, you know, really questioning, in a sense, his Americanism and his identity, and became a conduit for a lot of frustration that some cultural conservatives have with the president, but also with the sense, palpable in some ways on both sides of the aisle, that elites have managed to rig the system for their benefit, that financial institutions that implode in part because of misdeeds will get bailed out, but that the people who were involved in those misdeeds would not get prosecuted, whereas people on the lower end of the economic stick might get thrown out of their houses if they're foreclosed upon or might be sued for other kinds of debts. There's that sense, and he's tapped into it, and he's been brilliant with his rhetoric in doing that, even as a lot of people find I find ominous the degree to which he seems to embrace the idea of violence as a part of political discourse and seems to embody a hostility to the press. The press, I mean, there's a key thing about this. You characterized it exactly right at the top of your question. I do think that they missed the story that he would have staying power and that he would be meaningful to this race. And I don't totally blame the press for that, and because if you're looking at the press in isolation, it's very damning, but so did the entire Republican establishment. But on the other hand, they've helped to enable it because they don't know what Trump will do or say next. And therefore, that's a very intoxicating thing for live cable TV. Mm-hmm. You know, the most valuable events on TV are major sporting events because you don't know what the outcome will be. You don't know who will win unless there's a blowout in the first part of the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what advertisers like to, you know, that's why Super Bowl is such a big deal. That's why March Madness is such a big deal. In this instance, Trump was kind of a combination of March Madness and every time being a Super Bowl. And he would find a way to either say things that were very stimulating for voters or say things that were appalling that the political class would get outraged about, tear its hair about, denounce him for, and make sure that even when he wasn't speaking, they would be talking about him for days on end. Well, if you're Jeb Bush, if you're Marco Rubio, if you're Ted Cruz, if you're John Kasich, if you're any of these folks, it's going to be very hard to break through that. So Trump, by being very hostile to the press, has managed to make it about him and the press as opposed to him and some other specific candidate. And he's been able to take up time and attention that way. He's been able to drive the news cycle by being omnipresent in a way that, you know, Hillary Clinton, you could have thought that she was in a cave in Tora Bora in Afghanistan somewhere at times, because there were long stretches when she mm-hmm. thought she had this nomination locked up where she didn't want to be doing interviews. She didn't want to be doing debates, and she would not be taking questions except in very specifically chosen areas. And I think that's to her – that's a point against her, I would say, because I favor candidates coming before the people. In a sense, Donald Trump's willingness to go on cable TV is admirable. But because he's so good for ratings, the cable networks have been willing to contort themselves, and they are not wrapping his conversations around rigorous scrutiny, around tough examinations of not only how vague his policy pronouncements are, but how deeply disruptive some of them would seemingly be if he intends to keep his word, which I think is a totally open question. So you have a candidate who is this, you know, chaos agent, as Jeb Bush, you know, memorably suggested. And as a result of that, vast swaths of real estate on cable TV are essentially handed over to the guy. You know, after one of the primary nights, he took questions, and those questions ate up a great portion of the coverage, even though Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz and others wanted to speak. A consulting firm working for Marco Rubio, a firm called Optimus, estimated that those 44 minutes of time were worth about $2.8 million in the equivalent of advertising he would have to buy. And it also prevented anyone else from getting that time. That was I found that in an article in Politico. There are little things like that that tell you how smart he is, how deft he is about using the media, even as we think often of him as a coarse, blustery, buffoonish figure. He is, but he has a gut instinct, and he really is relying mostly on instinct here, of how to use the media, what buttons to press to make himself look impressive, and what ones to press to make everybody scurry and surround him as the topic. Because if you are incapable of being embarrassed, then shame is not something that can be pinned to you. There's no way in which there's a negative story about you. I mean, here's a guy who took a while to distance himself from the endorsement of the former leader of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke. And he hedged and took a little while to get there, and with facing questions for several days about the Klan. Now, there is no group that is in some ways more untouchable in American society than that. We know as a society that these guys represent something evil. And yet he took his time, and he ate up all this news hole and all this airspace, and he does not seem to have paid for it at the polls.
And it was interesting you mentioned in your talk that he was on the telephone on television being interviewed over the phone, which is has been rather unusual until Donald Trump in cable news.
He does like to do it by phone. I think it's a way in which he forces the networks to accommodate him. You know, you do see it over time, but usually you see it from somebody who can't get to a studio. They may be in, you know, Kurdistan. They may
right.
be in
It's usually
abroad.
For breaking news.
It's for breaking news. Yeah. It's for somebody who's just, you know, may not be part of your network, or somebody running for president can usually – you can find a way to get them on camera if they want to be on camera. And TV stations value that because it's a visual medium, because viewers can see body language. They can see facial expressions. It usually prevents aides from handing somebody a sheaf of papers that they can read off talking points. It makes it harder for somebody just to hang up and say, oh, I'm so sorry, I have to go. If it's a phone conversation, it's a little less brusque than if you're on camera. You have to pick a microphone off your lapel, throw it down and walk off screen. And that's a much more hostile act, and it comes off poorly. It'll be replayed hundreds of times. If you're on phone, you can say, oh, I can't quite, oh, you know, and then the phone line drops. They can do that. He can also do a ton of phone interviews from his desk or from, you know, in his pajamas or however he wants to on the same morning. And so it means he can dominate interview after interview after interview on channel after channel after channel by phone. As a result, TV channels, cable stations have tended away from that. It was notable when CBS this morning, meaning the show, CBS this morning, mm-hmm. made the decision not to accept him by telephone and said, you know what, thanks, but we'll get you when you can be on camera. He had been scheduled to be on camera, according to reports in, I believe, Politico and the New York Times, didn't like the lighting or didn't like the way in which the camera angles were working. And he said, fine, forget it. I'll just do it by phone. And they said, you know what, we want to get you on camera. We'll get you another time. And that was – it's not really a meaningful moment, except it was a signal that they were sending that they didn't want him to jerk them around. They didn't want him to dictate the terms of discourse. They felt that if they're providing access to their airwaves, they want to do it on their own terms.
Do you think Donald Trump will continue to call the shots with the media He missed a debate. He staged his own event instead of going to a debate. If he's the nominee, will he get away with doing that with the Democratic nominee in the fall,
so,
missing a debate?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting and open question. He recently, Fox News had wanted to stage a debate, another debate with Cruz and Kasich and Trump. And Trump, who has fought with Fox ever since the first debate back in August and made that debate about him and Fox as opposed to him and the other candidates, Trump just said, no, I've done enough. Thanks. And the debate instantly, of course, fell apart. You know, Trump is the front runner. I think Trump is going to be, he is just an unconventional candidate. If you look at his relationship with Fox, it's particularly unlike any relationship a Republican candidate has had in Fox in its 20 years of existence. It is used to setting the tone and tempo of the Republican political process. You know, there aren't back rooms anymore. We're talking about the possibility of a brokered or an open convention for the Republicans. But, you know, those used to be decided before the primary system was set up a little bit more formally in back rooms, smoke-filled rooms, you know, all the cliches. And Fox sort of looked at it itself as the smoke-filled room. It would help to determine who the serious candidates were, who were the people that they would give time to, who would they would elevate, not simply with their opinion shows, but on the story threads that they pursue in their news programming. And individual stories might well be very fair and very thorough about those controversies, but by the mere repetition of storylines that might be favorable to one candidate or negative to another, and by the consistency of the direction in which they went, Fox could sort of put its thumb on the scales to try to elevate one candidate or depress another.
And you wrote a book on this, we should mention.
Well, I wrote a book about particularly Rupert Murdoch, the head of the company that owns and created Fox. And Fox was obviously a very big part of that book.
NPR's Ethics Handbook says that they'll report and produce stories that treat all views fairly. Is it possible for more extreme views to game the system in a way? And I'm thinking of, for example, climate change, where there's a preponderance of science that says climate
change.
Yeah.
More than that.
Okay. How does NPR handle that kind of issue?
So let me first just underscore, because I'm not sure if I have this morning, that you know, I'm paid by NPR to critique the media. NPR is part of the media, but I don't speak for NPR. They may look at this differently than I do.
Okay.
I do think that our ethics policy is one of the clearest and better ethics policy in journalism. And what I like is that it's available to everybody. It's just at ethics.npr.org. And it's written in very clear English so that it can be understood. And it's not printed out in a booklet form for reporters because it's an evolving document, a breathing document. And it evolves as instances suggest, and it also evolves as best practices emerge that might change a bit over time. I think climate change is probably the topic, and I've done reporting about this over the years, that has been most difficult for the press to deal with. But the overwhelming majority of science and the overwhelming majority of scientists agree with the fact that the Earth's climate is warming, that it will have incredible repercussions for life on the planet, and that man-made emissions and activities have propelled that. It doesn't mean that they're exclusively doing that, but that they have propelled that. And within that science, there's uncertainty about how it's going to play out. There's uncertainty about how grave it will be, how much accommodation we can make, how remediable it is or manageable it is. There's a broad band of uncertainty about precisely in what ways these ramifications will play out. But there's almost no scientific research that casts doubt on that as a real phenomenon that's occurring and that one that people have to address. So if you present on the one hand, on the other hand, balance, you are doing a disservice to listeners if what you're doing is saying, well, on the one hand, we have this person who belongs to the National Academy of Sciences and is a professor at MIT. And on the other hand, we have somebody who's a professor in a perhaps not quite related field from another institute that turns out is funded by, for argument's sake, by petroleum companies. That's not responsible journalism. It is responsible to acknowledge that there are alternate points of view. It is responsible to acknowledge that a lot of those are, but not all, are funded by institutions that have a vested financial interest in keeping things for as long as possible in the way they are. You know, we are over a decade past the point where journalistically you can credibly listen to those voices as alternative scientists and say there's still dispute about whether or not this is occurring. It's just – it's inside like a 2% margin of error in terms of the number of scientists who believe this. Now, I would love for those other guys to be right, but that's a faith-based system as opposed to just listening to what our scientists, you know, are telling us, even as they acknowledge their own certainty about how some of that will play out. NPR is sometimes, I think, criticized for presenting things in sort of an agnostic fashion. But I think that if you listen to the best reporting on NPR and in the New York Times and other places, what they do is they do the reporting. And if there is a clear sense that the story lands in a certain place, that the facts take you to a place that an injustice has been done or that an accusation is false, they have to show their homework. They have to be very transparent about how that decision is reached, and they have to do their best to incorporate the strongest possible argument against whatever case is being made. You know, I don't think reporters should carry any partisan brief, at least not for NPR. I don't think reporters should be ideologues, at least not for NPR. I think we've got room enough for all different kinds of news organizations, and I think ideological news organizations sometimes bring some very interesting things to the table. But I think it's paramount that reporters be seen as honest brokers. The idea of an old-fashioned Associated Press approach where you just report what one person says and an opponent says and you're fine, that is not actually helping the Republic very much. I think doing your best to wade through competing arguments and then marshaling the best evidence to say, here's evidence to support this side and here's the argument that's against it, but there seems to be a case to be made that actually, you know, local officials were masking the level of lead in the water, as appears to have been the case in Michigan with state and regional officials there. You know, I think the news organizations need to be honest brokers if they're going to retain the trust of their audiences.
You've been in media a long time, in print, now in radio, and have seen a lot of changes. What do you see happening in this quickly changing media landscape in the future?
Oh, golly. Well, you know, I think places like NPR may end up being more indispensable than ever. I think we've seen an erosion of places, of the standing of places like the Baltimore Sun, where I used to work for a decade. I think a lot of regional news organizations have been weakened by the way in which people just don't expect to pay for things that they can get kind of for free online. Places at the higher levels, like the New York Times, have been able to get people to pay for it because they feel that's indispensable. I think NPR, the fact that they're able to get, if I may be so honest, listeners to voluntarily pledge money, that's an incredible – it's an important part of the financial system of public radio, but it's also an incredible testament to the degree to which people value public radio. I think that we're going to need more money from underwriters. I think we're going to need more major gifts, and I think we may need to ask more of our listeners a little bit. But I think that places that provide things that are not readily available and the kind of context and the kind of breadth of coverage NPR provides – I think is certainly unmatched in radio. I think it's, in a sense, unmatched by its seriousness of purpose in most broadcast or television outlets that are available in this country. I think it's going to be one of a handful of indispensable news organizations. I think you're going to see a lot of places bubble up that didn't exist before. The Marshall Project covers criminal justice issues. It's run by Bill Keller, the former editor-in-chief of the New York Times, and they're doing just tremendous work. ProPublica, Texas Tribune down in Austin, does tremendous work for them. It's a not-for-profit. BuzzFeed, as I mentioned earlier, BuzzFeed has doing some very, very strong reporting from the campaign trail, and also these researchers are doing some really good work. I sure wouldn't want to have BuzzFeed instead of the New York Times, but I'm happy for it to coexist. Very different, a viral social media site that nonetheless is doing some important journalism. So I am hopeful that we see a flourishing of a bunch of different kinds of players and actors in journalism, even as I'm concerned about the kind of accountability watchdog journalism that used to be done by the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Baltimore Sun and the Miami Herald and a bunch of great
and
regional
local papers.
And local papers. And those are simply by financial realities not able to do not only all that they did, but even perhaps a majority of what they used to do before. There's still some great work being done at those newsrooms, but it's despite, not because of the financial models they have.
David Folkenflik from NPR, thank you very much.
Oh, you bet. My great pleasure.
That was David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News. His stories are heard on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Here and Now, as well as on NPR's website and mobile platforms. To hear other interviews in the Take Note series, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.